We're doing our class on Pirkei Avot and the Jewish home. We'll dedicate our learning to Moshe ben Mordechai, whose Yahrzeit is coming up on Yedzayin Sivan. We're up to the first chapter, the eighth Mishnah. We've been going along with tradition, the order of the passing down of the oral law. And the Mishnah continues with the next pair of rabbis who headed the Jewish people, Yehuda ben Tabai, who was the Nasi, and Shimon ben Shatach. We know a lot of stories about him. He lived during time Yanai, when Yanai murdered all the rabbis, and Shimon ben Shatach hid. Yanai's servant once was taken to court, and Shimon ben Shatach sent word to him and said, Yanai, come to court. And Yanai begrudgingly agreed to come. And when he came, he said, Yanai, stand up and let the witnesses testify against you. And Yanai said, you're my brother-in-law. I know you're the chief rabbi. Let's see what the other rabbis say. Do they also say I have to stand? So he looked at the other rabbis, and they all got scared. They didn't say a word. And Shimon ben Shatach stood up and said, cursed are all of you. If you can't stand up for the halacha because you're scared of the king, God should take it from all you. And they all died. The Talmud says a frightening comment, but I don't know if we could take it literally, that an angel came and hit them all down right away. But I don't know. At the end of the day, all the rabbis in that time were being chased by Shimon ben Shatach's brother-in-law. And who was the king? And his sister hid him. So Shimon ben Shatach wasn't hiding. He made it out. So at any rate, our chief rabbis are Yehuda ben Tabai, who is the Nasi, and Shimon ben Shatach, who is the head of the court. Kiblu Mayim, they received their tradition from Yoshua ben Prachya, who was, I mean, it's not really his claim to fame, but just a way of dating him. I mean, his disciple was Yeshu, right? Yeshu was a disciple of Yoshua ben Prachya. And Nitai Harbeli, they were the people we learned about last week. So Yehuda ben Tabai and Shimon ben Shatach, now they were fitting students of Yoshua ben Prachya and Nitai Harbeli. So Yehuda ben Tabai, he's the Nasi, and he says the following, Altas atzmecha ke'orechei hadayanim. A person should not make himself like a lawyer, telling people you can make this claim or that claim. That's not our job. Let the person make his true claims and let the truth come out. וכשיהיו בעלי דינים עומדים לפניך יהיו ועיניך כרשעים. When people come before you for a court case, in order for you to judge fairly, you have to give both of them the worst of the doubt. Assume they're both wicked. If you assume, he's a pious person, he's walking into here dressed piously, his tzitzis are hanging to the floor, his face are hanging to his shoulders, he wouldn't do anything wrong, then you're not going to judge fairly. If you want to judge fairly, you look at both of them and assume they're both wicked people. And then you could start judging and see who's really telling the truth. But on the other hand, after you've judged, even if you've come to the conclusion that one of them did something wrong towards the other, look at both of them righteously, when they accepted the judging. Meaning if you've ruled it and they've accepted your judging, so assume he did it by mistake, he didn't mean to, he didn't know, he wasn't thinking at the time. You have to be able to look at both of them favorably. And in life, this Mishnah is really telling us a phenomenal concept that Rav Bigun often refers to. And it's a question of controlling the way we view things, controlling our emotions, controlling our attitudes to people. People sometimes enter marriage and they think they're always going to love their wife. So we've often discussed that there are two levels in love. There's Ahavat Olam and Ahavah Rabba. There's eternal love and then there's the swelling love. If you're a photographer, and your wife gets angry at you and she throws your suitcase across the room and bashes your photography equipment and $30,000 down the tubes, you're going to have a difficult time having Ahava Rabba at that moment. You're not going to feel any swelling love that moment. And I'm telling you stories I heard. You know, I'm changing the facts a little bit. I'm changing the story a little bit. But at the end of the day, we have to know that there are those moments where a person is overtaken with his love and it's swelling. And then there are those moments where it ain't swelling, where quite the contrary, and the person has to have control. And the person has to maintain that avat olam. There's an eternal basis, an eternal love that's always there. And then there's the capacity to look back at something wrong that was done and be able to say, okay, that's a fine person I'm married to. And it's the couple who he begged her for years to seatbelt the kids, and then one time she didn't, and God forbid something happened and they lost the child, and then he has to remain married to this woman. Now, how does he look her in the eye after that? Or it's the couple who she fed him an experimental elixir and caused him to have an irrevocable disease, which we say is Adam and Eve, right? The first couple on the planet. She gives him the forbidden fruit and causes his death. How's that for a perfect marriage? And yet, they remain married, and it took time. Adam couldn't look her in the eye and build well with her for 130 years, which in their day and age, I guess, would be equal to 2 or 3 years an hour, or 10 years in our lives. But you know, marriages can go through ups and downs, and the downs can last a decade. That doesn't mean there's reason to get divorced. We have to know that we have to work on ourselves to be able to look positively at other people. And if a person is really honest with himself, then a person knows that he also does things that he shouldn't do. He also has his weak points where he doesn't live up to what he should do. So by her, it's seatbelting the kids. And by him, it's maybe he was at the engagement last week and drank a little bit and then drove. So nothing bad happened, thank God. But he endangered himself, other people. But did he do something right? No. We sometimes look dishonestly at the facts. And we say, but look at what happened. And we don't really think, well, wait a second, how many times could that have happened to me? Am I perfect? No. It takes honesty in order to be able to look positively upon others. Our sages say we tend to see in others the faults we ourselves have. And the Mishnah is telling us, with regard to a court case, the Mishnah is saying, in order to be honest, you have to be open to everything. But at the end of the day, you have to be able to look positively at people, even though you've come to the conclusion that they were wrong. There's another point here which is important for the chinuch of our kids. You're going to encounter this many times as you bring up your children. A child walks in wailing. And you look at him and he's gushing blood on the side of his face, or he's got a black and blue mark, or whatever the case may be, his shirt is torn, and you say, what happened? And he starts wailing and he tells you a story. And before you know it, you're all riled up and you're ready to react. Remember this Mishnah. The Mishnah says when you have to judge, you have to assume everyone could be a liar. So the kid could come home and say the teacher was inhuman. The teacher locked me in the room for a half hour straight. And you're going to get on that phone and call the principal and ask, what kind of people do you have? You know, I could sue you for child abuse. What is this locking a kid in the room for a half hour straight? If you're an intelligent parent, what you're going to do is ask a question. What happened beforehand? Why were you locked into the room? And maybe you'll hear that the kids started lifting chairs and throwing them at other kids and bashed two windows in the process. And the teacher put him in a room and said, you know, you can come out of this room the second you calm down. And he refused to calm down for a half hour. And he was throwing chairs all over the room for a half hour. Maybe that's the story you missed. More often than not, there's a whole backdrop to the story that your kid is not telling you. And if you just ask him a few questions, you'll suddenly get a totally different story. Woe to the children whose parents rule based upon who cries louder. Very often you'll have two kids walking in and one of them is wailing. That doesn't mean he's the one that was wrong. It just means he's the one that knows how to wail. You have to stop and remember this Mishnah. Two people are coming before you and you have to judge, and in life we often have to judge. Both of them should be in your eyes as wicked. You don't know who's right. Very often people will come and tell me a story and they'll ask me what my opinion is halachically. And my answer is usually, if you want a halachic opinion, go to a rabbi with the person you have an argument with, let him sit down and hear you both out and let him rule for you. But I'm telling you the whole story, the guy says. Right, you're telling it to me from your perspective. And maybe he'll tell me a different angle that you're not thinking of. We had a guy here half a year ago, had a question of interest. He lent someone money or someone lent him money. I don't remember the whole story. And he came to me and asked what the halacha is, what he has to pay and doesn't have to pay. And I wasn't willing to answer him because the halacha says you want halachic ruling. I can't assume you're telling me the truth accurately. I could assume you're trying to give me an accurate picture the way you see it. And Chazal say, we're all biased. Everyone's partial, the Talmud says. So I can't assume anyone's telling the truth. I have to assume everyone's partial. After the court case, I have to assume everyone's fine and dandy, right? That's what the Mishnah concludes with. Don't get carried away. Don't be walking around thinking, he's a liar and he's a liar. They're both liars. No. Well, you left the courtroom. They're both good people. Mishnah Tet, Shimon ben Shatach Omer, Shimon ben Shatach says, and if we could ask people to put their cell phones on silent, it's really disturbing to the listeners to hear all this music in the middle. Shimon ben Shatach Omer, Shimon ben Shatach says, Hevei marbe lachkor ta'idim. Do a thorough questioning when witnesses come in, because maybe you'll hear a contradiction. Maybe as you talk to them, you'll suddenly hear them contradicting themselves. Do a thorough cross-examination. Be careful what you say. Shema mitocham yilmedu leshaker, lest they learn to lie from within your own words. So be careful. You talk too much. They might understand things from you. Okay, so this Mishnah pertains primarily to court. Shmaya v'Avtalion kiblu mehem. Shmaya and Avtalion were the chief rabbis. They were Geirei Tzedek. They were both Geirim. They were the Nasi and Av Bezdin, and they received their tradition from Yehuda ben Tabai and Shimon ben Shatach. Shmaya and Avtalion were the teachers of Hillel and Shammai. And Shmaya and Avtalion were descendants from Sancheriv. Sancheriv, who exiled the 10 tribes. Our sages say that Avtalion wasn't really his name, but rather he was the head of the court, and a lot of orphans would gather in his home, children whose parents couldn't afford to feed them, or children out of wedlock. So they gave him the nickname Av, father of Talion. Talia in Aramaic means child. Av Talion, father of children, because all the children who were left out would gather in his home, and he had a lot of orphans in his home. So Shmaya and Avtalion, they received their tradition from Yehuda ben Tabai and Shimon ben Shatach. Shmaya Omer, Shmaya says the following, Ehov et hamelacha. A person should love work. Well, we live in a day and age where people are always looking for a vacation. Right? People say, I work. You have these signs that teachers wear. I'm a teacher for the months of July, June, July, August, right? Whatever the intercession is. Our sages told us our attitude should be positive towards work. A person should view work positively. If a person doesn't have sustenance, so then he has to have a job. And our sages said, don't look down at any job. In their days, the lowest job was stripping animals of their hides in the marketplace. So the Talmud says, better be stripping hides in the marketplace than having to ask other people for a handout. Chazal said to the rabbis, they said, "Pshot nevela bashuk, be the one to undress the carcasses in the marketplace, v'al titzlech labiriyot, but don't come to a point where you need other people to feed you." A person should be proud if he's capable, then that's what he should do. That's our job. And a person's supposed to view it positively. It's an attitude. Now, the Mishnah says, love work. The Mishnah is telling you it's not only about putting bread on the table, it's about being productive in life. Very often people who are well off financially have many issues within their marriage because she doesn't need to work, so she has free time. She has free time, she's watching the soap operas. He has free time, he's surfing the net. He's not finding anything too positive out there. He's not finding the cure for cancer. And that leads to trouble. The Mishnah says, if one marries a wealthy woman who brings in many servants into the home, so then she can't sit back and say, what am I supposed to do for you, honey? The beds the maid does, the laundry the maid does. I brought in everything. Everything that needed, the cooking the maid does. If the wife says, I brought in so many servants that there's nothing for me to do, her husband could say, I want you to weave. And she'll say, but what do I have to weave for? I have servants who could do it. The Mishnah says, if a person is sitting bored, boredom leads to promiscuity and to insanity. Machlokas in the Mishnah, which one is it going to lead to? But it's not going to lead to anything positive. So a husband can demand of his wife, even though you brought in all the servants in the world, you don't need to work for a penny. You need to work to be productive in life. You can't sit back and do nothing. You can't just sit in bed and watch TV. You can't do that. And a husband has a right. Now, the flip side of it is that a wife also has a right. The wife is entitled to feel that her husband is productive too. Sometimes a guy could be learning in yeshiva for 20 years and his wife feels like he's not doing anything. So firstly, he's got to be smart and share with her his successes and what he is doing. And secondly, he might have to go and be a rabbi of a community or a teacher, even though financially it's not necessary. But one of the things that couples owe one another is that both partners in a marriage are entitled to feel that they're married to someone successful. And success is measured personally. So she can't tell him, look, I need to feel like you're the biggest hotshot on Wall Street, so go learn finances and do that. That's already going too far. But if he's doing something where she feels like she has a hard time respecting him, so then he has to know that that is a concern. He owes that to her too. Now, hopefully these are things you discuss while you're dating. But at the end of the day, she might say, you know, when I was dating you, they told me you were the top student in the yeshiva. And ever since then, I've wisened up, and I'm not so happy. And then he has to think what he's going to do. A person has to have an attitude that he loves being productive. When they asked Rabbi Feinstein about teaching secular studies in the schools, so one of the points he said in his response is, if you're going to do it well. The students have to be accustomed to doing whatever they do well in life. So if you're going to have secular studies in the school, the students have to have serious secular studies where they're successful at it. Whatever time you're doing, whatever you're allocating, they have to be accustomed to doing what they're doing well. And that's an attitude in life. One has to have the attitude that he wants to be productive. One has to have the attitude that he wants to succeed in whatever it is he does. Usna et Ravanut. Second point that Shmaya taught us is a person should hate positions of authority. The nature of the human being is to want authority. It's one of the driving forces in all of humanity. Power. And we are taught that a person should try to shy away from that. A person has to feel like it's responsibility. And it really detracts from a person. On the one hand, we say that a person grows from the responsibility. On the other hand, we have a tradition that it shortens one's life. Yosef passed away first from all the siblings. He was one of the longest kings in Jewish history. His kingdom lasted one of the longest periods in Jewish history, 80 years. Where do you find a king for 80 years? And yet, he died young, younger than anyone else. And we have a tradition that that's because he was a leader. Look at all the presidents before and after. They aged like 50 years during their presidency. And you take the youngest president. The only one who didn't was probably Kennedy, who died. But I'm serious. Look at the president. I don't know what it'll be with this one, but you'll see it. Yes, sir.
So does that mean, like in a positive way, so we seek to find somewhere we can follow? We're supposed to hate being the leaders. We actively seek to find somewhere we can follow.
That was last week's Mishnah.
Okay.
Here it's a point that a person should shy away from a position of authority. Even being rabbi, the Talmud says there are many rabbis who ran away from it. In our centuries, you have many rabbis who have run away from it. The Gera Rebbe, when one passed away, so they went to his brother, and his brother said, there are others in line who want to be Rebbe, let them be before me. And he kept shying away. I think it was the Chidushe Harim, I don't remember which one of the Gera Rebbe's. So long as there was someone in the family who could take over the leadership, he said, let me learn. And he was really only Rebbe for the last few years of his life. He did a lot during those years. But usnat rabbanut, the Mishnah says a person should not want to be the leader because leadership only buries a person. It's responsibility. You grow from it. at the end of the day, it also varies the person. Remember, the one who's saying this is the Nasi, is the chief rabbi of Israel. He was there, but he was telling us an attitude. When you have to, you do it. Yes?
Which king was that for 80 years?
Joseph.
So how could he die young?
He died at 110, and all his siblings outlived him.
Okay.
Young is relative. Ve'al titvada la'rashut, and don't let yourself be known by the politicians. The leaders, the tendency of people is to want to have friends in high places. But a person has to know that at the end, when you're in touch with powerful people, you feel a pressure to appease them. And that pressure distances you from God. The closer you are to power, the more difficult it is to be a God-fearing person. To be a God-fearing person is that a person feels like there's one person I have to answer to. And when you're dealing with politicians, so it's difficult. Mishnah Yud Aleph, Avtalion Omer, Avtalion, who was the head of the courts, he says, Chachamim yizahru b'divrechem. Wise men, be careful what you say. Don't leave room for error. We have to word our sentences in a way that there's no room to be misunderstood. And that's very hard. Because on the one hand, you have to limit your words so that people can follow what you're saying. On the other hand, you have to be very, very clear. Shema tachuvu chovat galut. Because maybe you'll end up in exile, and there there'll be students who don't have a positive background, and they're trying to twist your words. And you'll go to a place where there's bad waters, which is a reference to bad students, and then your students, your good students, will come after you. And then the students that follow you will drink from those bad waters. The other students will say, you think the rabbi meant this? No, I meant that. And they'll convince him of misunderstandings in what you said if you weren't clear about it. The yamutu, and they'll die. Your own good students will lose the correct tradition. You can't assume just because right now you have a group and they understand you and everything's good, that's fine. No, you don't know where you'll end up and what other students will say in your name and how they'll misinterpret what you say. So you can't leave room for misunderstanding. And then God's name is desecrated with this misunderstanding of tradition. And Avtalion is referring to a historical occurrence when Yossi ben Yoezer said, don't serve God for the sake of the world to come. So he had two students sitting before him, Tzadok and Baitus, and they decided, well, it must be there is no world to come. And then they started a whole movement which led masses astray, led masses to the point where there were points in Jewish history where it seems like they were the majority, these movements. So Avtalion says, you have to be careful what you say. This Mishnah can't be stressed enough when it comes to marriage. The misunderstandings in marriage abound. And if you think it's only the first year you're married, you'll discover that it's after you're married 10 years too. There was once a couple who was on the phone, and it's Friday afternoon, and the husband is rushing home from work, and the wife tells him, just stop by our friends and pick up, the kugel for Shabbos. So the husband says, and where do they live exactly? So she says, just before the kids' school. They live just before the kids' school. The red house just before the kids' school. So the husband's driving, suddenly turns on him, wait a second, which direction am I coming from, you know? Or two directions you could come down that block. Which way is before the school? So he calls up his wife, and she says, what do you mean? I told you it's just before the school. And he says, yeah, I'm standing before the school, and I don't see a red house. So she says, oh, so where you're standing, you've got to go after the school. So he's going back and forth, and he's not finding the home. So he got all ticked. Why can't you give me an accurate address? Life is about misunderstandings. Back and forth, and people talk, and you will discover that in marriage it's endless misunderstandings. Sometimes you end the day and you ask yourself, did we understand one another more or less? Which was the majority of our conversations where we understood one another or didn't? And misunderstandings could lead us to far out conclusions. Very often a husband will clean the floor and the wife will be upset at the way he cleaned the floor. So the husband says, okay, tell me how you want me to clean the floor. And she'll tell him. And the second time, same solution. Third time, same thing. Fourth time, same thing. By the fifth time, he says, leave me. I tried. I can't. Whatever I do, you're not happy. Husband goes and does shopping. Comes home. Why'd you get that ketchup? No one eats that ketchup. Okay. And who said we needed tomatoes? I didn't ask you to get tomatoes. Wait a second. I just did the shopping. Isn't it good that I did the shopping? Well, I don't know if it's good or bad that you did the shopping, because now we're stuck with ketchup that no one's going to eat, and diapers that leak, and tomatoes that aren't good. Okay. How many times is that going to happen before the husband's going to say, don't ask me to do the shopping. I'll do something else, but I can't do the shopping. Some misunderstandings abound. And the first thing we have to know is that it's par for the course. Too many couples come and say, we just don't understand one another. We don't get along. Okay, so you're a normal couple. A guy once told me, I want to date a girl, I want to marry a girl who can talk straight and explain to me what she wants, and we understand one another. So I said to him, okay, so you don't want to marry a girl, in other words, right? That's what life is about. We are two people from two backgrounds. We talk the same language as far as the words, but we mean different things. And then when you add in the fact that we're male and female, so we talk different languages. And it's par for the course. So first thing is, a person shouldn't be frustrated by it. If you think you understand your wife, it's only that you don't yet understand what you don't understand. That's number one. In a normal marriage, there are many, many, many misunderstandings, and it keeps going for life. So then the question is, how do we react to those misunderstandings? So this class is before men, not women. So we have a few minutes. So we'll go off on a slight tangent just to understand one another a little bit better. One of the roots of misunderstandings between men and women is that we phrase our sentences differently. If I want to tell you that I'm upset at you, so as a man, what I'm going to think is just how upset, how much do I want you to understand I'm upset, and then I'm going to say something to that effect. If I'm a woman, I could say something along the lines of, I hate you. I wish I never married you. Now, when you hear that line as a man, you come back and say, wait a second. How could you talk that way? You wish you never married? You hate me? Why are you reacting that way? Because you're male. If a husband and a wife have an argument, and the wife says, I hate you, and the husband says, I hate you back, the wife gets all insulted. So then the husband says, wait a second, you said it to me, how come, what's going on here? So then the wife's going to say, yeah, but you meant it. And she's right. She's right. Because we gauge our speech based upon thought. Their speech is a tool to express emotion. It's like when a wife says there are a million bugs in the drawer. You know, if you said there were a million bugs, you'd mean there's an anthill. There's a swarming amount of bugs there. If she says there's a million bugs, there might be two. There might be one. What's the difference? Because they're not talking the speech and the semantics. The terms, our sentence structure is totally different. So what often happens in the first year of marriage is that husbands come back and they say, I wouldn't talk to my worst enemy that way. I would never talk to anyone that way. I can't believe that she would talk that way to me. And what makes it worse, what really aggravates the situation, is that back in a person's mind, in the subconscious, a person is comparing her to his mother. Who was the woman in his life before he married her? His mother. She never said she hated him, guaranteed. You know, that never happened. Whatever happened, his mother was positive to what happened. Well, his wife is his partner. His wife isn't his mother. The next thing that's in the back of a person's mind is how he saw his parents' marriage. Now, you guys are forgetting that by the time you began understanding your own parents' marriage, you guys were how old? 10? 15? So if they're divorced, so that's in the backdrop as a negative. And if they remain married, so that's in the backdrop as a different type of negative. You know, I never saw my parents talking this way to one another. Don't worry. 20 years down the road, I wish you won't be talking that way too. But it takes time. And in the beginning, the emotions run high. and we don't understand one another. When she says, I hate you, what she's saying is, I'm very, very upset at you. So you'll say, wait a second, then why is she talking that way? She's talking that way because she's a woman. So you say, but I don't want my wife to talk that way. And I'll tell you, get used to it, or don't marry a woman, one or the other. And you have no other option in Judaism, so get used to it. That's it. It's the way of the world. Their talking is an expression of emotion. And if a husband comes home and he does a shop, and the wife says, remind me to never again ask you to do the shop, and then the next time she asks him to do the shop, he says, honey, you remember you want me to remind you something? That's not what she meant. Again, the words are a way of expressing what they're feeling. But you can't take a woman's words and start dissecting it and say, but this is what you said. You guys following me? If you learned nothing in this class but this point, it was worth coming here tonight. Believe me, damn it. Yes?
I was just wondering, in a situation in which your wife is yelling at you, or speaking to you in such a way, is there any way to defuse the situation, or is it best to just sit there and take it until she cools off?
Let me ask you, if your friend were yelling at you, is there one formula? Depends on what the background is.
With a friend, sometimes I would assume that most people would try to yell back, or at least argue the point. Right. You know, it's not like such a... Like you could go home and not see your friend for a few days.
Right. So Shlomo Melech taught us, Ma'ane rach meshiv chema. Answering softly repels anger. But the Talmud says, why is it that when women anger, it takes them much longer to calm down than men? So the Talmud says, each one from the place they were created. She was created from a bone, so she's tough as a bone. We're created from earth, so we're soft like earth. People always think that women are soft, right? No, it doesn't work that way. They're soft in other ways. But with their husbands, they're tough as nails. And the Talmud says that's normal in a good relationship. Talmud says their anger shoots higher than men's anger, and it's much harder to quell. And that's normal. Like a guy came to me and said he had to get divorced. So I wasn't about to question it. You know, he came to me after the fact. But he wanted to convince me that he's okay. He had to get divorced because his wife was yelling at him till 2 in the morning. Whoa. So I didn't want to tell him, you know, I don't buy that. I'm sorry. I understand she was yelling at you till 2 in the morning. Whether she was in the right or she was in the wrong is a different question. But that's a reason to get divorced. So swallow it. So you say you didn't sleep well tonight. Fine. You know, there are nights like that, and after a period, things calm down. You got to remember, you got to view things in the long term. Will she be yelling at you every night for the next 80 years? No, there will be nights when it feels like it's been every night for a long time. But marriages go through highs and lows. There's no guarantee. Right now, it feels this way. Later, it'll feel this way. Marriages have highs and lows. And the problem is that we live in this society which paints a picture of they lived happily ever after. No such concept. You know, I tried interviewing. Whenever I'm at a wedding or something and I sit next to old people, so I try to learn from them. You know, I can't talk to them Torah usually. I mean, sometimes, yeah. But if not, so very often they're very interested in talking to you. So one of the questions I've asked, and I've asked this to a lot of old people, What tips can you give our generation about marriage? I try asking this to a lot of old people. You know, old people are dying to talk, especially to our generation. So if you're with your grandparents or things like that, ask them. Hear what tips they have to say. And one of the recurring themes that I keep hearing from older people who are married for 50, 60, 70 years, I met a couple, they were on Facebook, grandparents of a friend of mine. They were celebrating, I don't remember if it was 70 years married or 80 years married. I mean, they're close to a century old, and so you ask a couple like that for tips, it's worth hearing. You know, they stuck it out for a while. So their grandson used to come to Daf Yomi Shir I gave, so that's how I got to know them. And it turns out that they were friends with my grandparents, who are not with us for already a few decades. One of the recurring themes you hear from older people is that marriage is about sticking it out when things are not pleasant. You think that if they stuck it out for 80 years, they always had it good, everything was great. I love those stories. Whenever I hear those stories, I try to talk to the people who are described as always having it great. You hear a lot of stories about couples that everything was always perfect. Everything was always blossoming. So I used to believe that. I was once young and gullible too. So but then I said, let me check it out. So you talk to these people and you ask them, what tips can you give me about marriage? And suddenly they're sharing with you about the difficulties that crop up in marriage. And I'm talking about wives of big rabbis. I got to ask questions. Wives of the leaders of the Jewish people. You know, if I was there at a Shabbos meal, so I'd ask a question, you know, what tip can you give me? And you suddenly hear a totally different story. So what we have to know is that this is the norm. This isn't the exception. The norm is that there's rough roads and there's smooth roads, and the rough roads can last a while and the smooth roads can last a while. And sometimes one day it's like this, and one day it's like that, and 1 hour it's like this, and 1 hour it's like that. Things take time. The message that has to be a constant there is the idea of there's a constant love, there's a constant dedication, and this is going to last and this is going to work, and we're never questioning that. Our attitude is this is it. Once we walked out of that chuppah, that's it. We're together for life. Now, how it's going to work out, maybe you'll discover that you can't watch your Sunday football game because your wife is not going to have that. And that's a small price to pay if you have real perspective. But suddenly when you say, wait a second, she's not letting me play my Sunday football game. She's not letting me buy ices because she says we can't afford it. I can't have hot dogs anymore because she says it's not healthy. I can't have soda anymore because she says it's not healthy. Suddenly my whole life is looking different. Yes, your whole life is looking different. But if you think about it realistically, it's small fry. There was a couple who was dating. Story goes back 40 years ago. I heard this from the couple again. And everything was interesting and everything was going well and everything was going fine. And every time he'd start smoking, she'd ask him to put out the cigarette. And he'd smoke and she'd ask him to put out the cigarette. 40 years ago, they didn't know the problems with smoking, right? But she hated the smell. So at one point, she said to him, you know, I told you it gives me a headache when you smoke cigarettes. So he says to himself, this is him, I'm quoting him, she's going to tell me not to smoke? This is who I am, I smoke, she's going to tell me not to smoke? So he called her up the next day and said, look, I respect you and I think you're a fine person, but I don't think we're going to be able to continue together. So she was devastated and he was devastated. And he meets up with a friend 2 days later, and his friend tells him, you look like you're a wreck. What's going on? So he tells him the story. He says, I don't know what's wrong with this girl. She thinks I'm going to tell her, I'm going to change my whole life because she doesn't like my smoking. So his friend looks at him and says, you know, you are crazy. So he says, why am I crazy? He says, you met a girl, everything makes sense. For a cigarette, you're not going to marry her? That's where you're holding? For a cigarette, you're not going to marry the girl? So he looks at his friend, and his friend says, I can only tell you, if you give up on this girl because of a cigarette, you're crazy. And he married her. I know their kids, I know their grandkids. They tell this story today. But sometimes when you're in the heat of the moment, so suddenly you feel like, wait a second, my football game, my hot dogs, my soda, she's going to tell me what to do? Marriage is about compromise. I can only guarantee you that your wife is compromising more than you are. You just won't realize it till you're into the marriage 10 years. But I can guarantee you, any marriage, I mean, let's say 99.999% of the marriages, the wife is compromising more than the husband, only the husband doesn't recognize it till maybe 10 years down the road. So most husbands will say, I'm that 0.0001%, guarantee. Talk to the average husband, the first 2-3 years of marriage, will say, no way. But no, it's not a... Yeah.
When you say there can be 10 years of downs, how literally are we supposed to take that?
Literally. Literally. What do you mean? Imagine Adam and Eve, 130 years, where he's having trouble getting together with her. I mean, she just destroyed the world, right? I'm serious. She did. I'm saying... And there are other stories that way. We have a class online where we wrote just a series of stories from Tanakh. The devastating stories. I mean, imagine he doesn't know what she's feeding him and she kills him. Okay, so it's a slow death. It's going to take 1,000 years, which they didn't know at the time how long it would take. But she caused his death. End of story. And he continued, right? And there are other stories that way. I mean, if you want to look through Tanakh, let's take the story of the guy who ends up married to the girl who he didn't even want to marry. How's he going to look her in the eye? Yaakov and Leah. He didn't want to marry her. I mean, what worse shidduch could he have on the planet? He wanted her sister. She tricked him. He's married to her. I don't know. I don't know of a person on in today's day and age who wouldn't say that's grounds for divorce. I didn't want to marry her. She tricked me. Is there a more evil act than that? Think about it. And yet their marriage worked. And we don't have a single word that there were fireworks there. The Torah describes it that he didn't have the affinity for her that he had for Rachel. There wasn't a... she didn't feel the budding relationship that he had with Rachel. It was different. She felt it. Okay. And even there, you see that God didn't side with him, which makes you wonder. God sided with her and had her have the majority of Israel. The Kohuna, the Malchus, Mashiach, David, everything from Leah. Why? So it doesn't seem to work the way we think. Marriage is not about, I dreamt of her. I've been working for 7 years. You know, it's not just he dreamt it for Rachel. Imagine the shidduch. He's chasing after the girl. He works for her for 7 years. And then he gets her sister and he's supposed to build a home with her. What was God thinking? Think about that. I guess marriage can work even if it's not exactly who we thought we were going to marry. Even if it's a totally different person. A twin sister who's not so good looking. And he didn't even want to marry. And yet God expects that marriage to work. And the people of Israel are built from that marriage. So it's not just an expectation, it's a reality. It's something to think about. Yeah, Yonatan.
Rabbi, I have a question. Let's say I'm married in the skits in the end. How does...
Bezrat Hashem. We're waiting. Yeah.
Okay, but let's say there's a fight in the house. Not a bad fight. Like the usual parents fight. Like mom and dad is fighting before the kids. What should one do? Go inside the room? Speak about it? And how do one handle it when one of the kids... It's like making problems, and you have to educate between parents.
So first thing is, I think parents have to come to an agreement that their arguments should not be in front of the kids. They should do their utmost to swallow. And usually what happens, how does a fight erupt? He says something, she says something. And now the flames are starting to flare. Now, each one feels like, okay, I'll get one more line in, and then we'll talk in the bedroom. Right? So, be a man, and swallow your pride, and if you really want to be a man, so be a gibor, like the Mishnah says, ezu gibor kovesh titzro. We have to remember a rule in marriage. It takes one to tango. Remember that rule. It takes one to tango. It takes two to get a divorce. It takes one to make a good marriage. Okay? So people can't walk into this and say, I'm the only one giving. Good for you. So thanks to you. This is going to be a positive home and you'll build an excellent home together. And it's fine. I guarantee that if you talk to her, she'll view it the other way. But I don't care. Let's ignore that for a minute. Let's say that you're right. You're the one that's making this marriage work. Great. So when you get to Shemayim, you'll have such a stack of mitzvahs, you know, bigger than the whole town here. Stacks of mitzvahs because you made the marriage work and you made your kids' education work and you made a Kiddush Hashem. I don't care. I don't care. You know, people are looking for this fairness. I give, she give. No, I'm not looking for fairness. You could be the one that's keeping the marriage going. I don't care. So it's all on your shoulders. Mine, it's all on your shoulders.
How can you love a person that's not able to perform? Let's say
the more you give, the more you love. Love is about giving.
You will.
The more you give her, the more you will love her. So keep giving and you'll love her. Don't worry. It's a rule in life. Two things. I'm going to tell you two things. I know what I'm telling you sounds
rich.
100%. The more you give, the more you love, and love is a decision. Love is a decision. Love is not what Western society tells you, that it's, now I'm overtaken and she's... Guys, I'm telling you so many one-liners here tonight. Wow, but you got to remember this. Yosef, I'm serious. I'm not joking. Love is a decision, and Adam's father will back me on that, or his mother, one of them. If you decide that you're going to invest in this and build with this person, which is what you better decide if you're going to walk down that aisle, then you have to decide to love the person. Now, okay, this is long. We're never going to get to Rus.
Is there a justification for the concept of divorce? It shouldn't be at all. It shouldn't be completely.
How does the Torah describe divorce? Torah says if the husband sees that his wife is cheating on him and is doing things that are borderline adultery, then the Torah describes divorce. Right. There are red lines. Those are the red lines. Not because you don't love her. You don't love her, so work on yourself. No, I don't care who you marry. If you decide to love her, you will love her. That's up to you.
Yeah, but let's say you love her and you got married, and then suddenly...
Every woman you marry will suddenly turn out to be a witch. Guaranteed. And that's a blessing, not a curse. Just a second. Yeah, Gidon. One thing, I'm serious. I don't understand. You guys have been to this class all semester. You guys don't know this? Every person wakes up after marriage at some point and says, this is not who I thought I was marrying. You guys are supposed to know this by now. That's what life is about. Any person you marry, I don't care. She could be Queen Esther. I mean, if you're an Achashverosh and she's scared you'll chop her head off, then maybe she'll behave like, you know, Esther also, you know, she prayed before she actually approached Achashverosh. Yeah, if that's the type of relationship you want, then you'll probably find yourself in jail. But no, it's any relationship you walk into, it's not going to be that way. Yeah, Gidon.
Brother, what happens if you find yourself in a situation where you might possibly love someone that you're not, like, not love them, but, like, say you like someone and you don't think, like, you made this decision to like or love somebody, but, like, then they might not be right for you. So, like, once you make the decision, you kind of have to, just march forward. Like,
you're talking before marriage or after marriage?
Either.
Before marriage deserves its own class. After marriage, yes. 100%. After marriage, you have to understand. In every marriage, every day, there are, I don't know if to say tens or hundreds, it depends on how much time the couple are spending together, but there are at least tens, if not hundreds, of irksome things that happen. It's par for the course of two people being together under the same roof. I could tell you fantastic stories. I once visited, we're never going to get to Rus like this. if you want to, one of the nice things in Judaism is that you can access the giants of the Jewish people. If you want to meet Rabbi Yashiv, you could call a certain number and you could get an audience with him. It'll take a month, it'll take 2 months, but you could get to see him. You want to meet Netanyahu? I don't think you could. I'm serious, I'm not joking. I'm saying... And that's the way it is. The giants of the Jewish people are here for us. That's what they're there for. So I took advantage of this in my youth. I had more time to chase after this. And I got to see many of the giants of the Jewish people. So I once had an appointment to meet with a certain rabbi when he came to Jerusalem. So more than once, I had once where I made up to meet with a rabbi. I traveled all the way north. And as I'm getting off the bus over there in his town, I get a phone call that there was an emergency meeting and he's on his way to Jerusalem. So I said, okay, can I meet you on the highway or something? You know, you'll give me a ride back, we'll talk in the car. But he couldn't make it. So very often, big rabbis, they don't have control over their own schedule. And sometimes their plans change. So I come to his home and he's not there. So I wasn't comfortable coming in, you know. We made up a time, we made up a place, but he is not there. So his wife says, no, you come in. And when he comes back, boy, am I going to let him have it. I go, oh, really? And when he came back, oh, you should have heard what went on there. And she was I was embarrassed. I thought I'd bury myself under the seat. You know, we have this vision that you have this couple. He's an old man. He's one of the giants of the Jewish people. So his wife is going to be like, oh, very nice and respectful. You should have seen. And it was like, it was almost comical. He got a phone call from a very, very old woman. A woman who had a shayla and she was like 110 or something. and I guess it was the relative or something. So this was while I was there. So she was like, wait till the rabbi comes home, I'm going to show him. In front of me, he comes home, she says, you had such an important phone call this afternoon, I'm not going to tell you who it was. I'm standing there, this is in front of me. She was very upset that he made an appointment with someone and he wasn't there on time. As I'm standing there, she tells him, you know, I always told you you should be with someone who has a phone so I could contact you, and people are waiting and you made up a time. Okay, now you tell me, is that what you imagined goes on in that house? Not what I imagined, right? Okay, but if you'd ask him, he'd tell you he's in total bliss. Do you think he enjoyed sitting there in front of me and having his wife talking to him that way? I don't think so. I didn't enjoy it, but it taught me something. It taught me something. Our perspective is, if he's so big and he seems so happy and we have so much to learn from him, so obviously his marriage is going to look like A, B, or C. He has no control. I could tell you a story of another big rabbi who was at a kiddush, and his wife was big into his diet. So she was very focused on his diet. So he was in the men's section, and they had good lox there, and he's taking lox. And she's standing in the women's section with her hands on her hips, looking at him, staring, glaring at him. And he's taking another one, and he's thinking, believe he doesn't see her. Okay, so, you know, she decided that she knew better than him, that he's supposed to be on a diet. And he knew better than her. He held that logically he wasn't at a state where that would make a difference in his life. He was right. He ended up dying from something else. And okay, so she's got gung-ho on this. He doesn't see her. Fine. They were once at another simcha, and she's talking to her friend right next to him. She's facing this way, and he's sitting here, and his son is there, and they serve dessert. So he finishes his cake. He does this to his son. He switches the plate. And he looks at her. He looks over his shoulder. Okay. And you're talking about someone who everyone learns in Svarim. You're not talking about a small person. You're talking about someone that everyone agrees he was one of the giants of the Jewish people. Okay, but his wife had an issue that she decided he has to be on a diet, and he didn't agree with her on it, and he couldn't take her on it. So, okay, so when she wasn't looking, he took the other cake. You know, you can't, Yonatan, that's what I'm telling you also. There's no such thing as a marriage that's not going to have its issues. It doesn't exist. And we're talking about all marriages. Chazal tell us specific stories from our sages in the Talmud also. And when you read the Tanakh, you suddenly see stories in Tanakh. So King David's wife goes out and berates him in front of the whole crowd. What's wrong with you dancing like that in front of everyone? Very interesting. Who is she? Who is he? He's a prophet, and who is she? She's the daughter of King Saul, but at the end of the day, the prophets tell us she didn't marry to have a child till the day she died because of the way she spoke to him. But you see, she spoke to him that way. You see, so if you look, you see that there's a certain norm here. And the norm is that there's going to be certain reactions, and there are going to be, and there can even be 10 years, David, where there are hardships in a marriage, and that doesn't mean anything. All it means is that you'll have to weather the storm and build after that. But that's a key point. You can't walk in thinking everything's going to be perfect. This is perfect. Perfect is about dealing with these hardships when they come, and not running away, but swallowing it, and knowing that, like, Gidon correctly pointed out earlier, you got no place else to run and hide. You're going to come back home every night, and sometimes it's going to be more pleasant, and sometimes it's going to be less pleasant, and sometimes it's going to be at the expense of sleep, and you're going to try to make peace, and you're going to invest in making peace, and you're going to have to forgo in order to make the peace, and at the end of the day, you'll have a beautiful home. But going back to what Yonatan raised, it is important, if at all possible, that the couple comes to an agreement, that the arguments are not in front of the kids, and if it should happen that a couple does argue in front of the kids, they have to know how to balance that and show positive emotion in front of the kids too, in a modest way. But kids have to see both. It's like a couple came to a rabbi once and asked him, is it okay if we say anything positive or show any positive emotion in front of the kids? Isn't it immodest? So the rabbi said, it's more modest when you argue in front of them. If you're as careful about not arguing in front of them as about showing any emotion, then we could talk. So we have to remember that kids need to feel secure in the home. And one of the most hurtful things you could do to kids in the home is to berate or argue with one another in front of the kids. You should never berate one another, even if you disagree. It shouldn't get to that level. But whatever does happen should not be in front of the kids. Okay, so we got to all of this from our Mishnah, which said, wise men, be careful with what you say, because a person can end up being misunderstood or have people who purposely misunderstand him and then mislead others from what he said. And we said that this is all the more so within a marriage where we have to be careful what we say, and that as careful as we are, there will always be misunderstandings. And one of the keys is, how do we react to the misunderstandings? That's how we started all this discussion. There will be misunderstandings. It's par for the course. The question is, how do you react when they happen? Okay.